Chapter 46. Kanu had been wrong about the moons, but he could be forgiven for that. Even Icebreaker had been confused by them, its sensors registering them only as small, black, mathematically spherical bodies. As one of the objects closed upon them, though, he began to grasp his error. The moon was only spheroidal, in the way a spinning coin defines the shape of a sphere. The moon was winding down, turning ever more slowly on its axis. The rotational speed was still almost too fast for the naked eye to interpret, but now, at least, the ship was having less difficulty. He stared at the images and overlays on the bridge display, the patchwork of analysis and interpretation the ship was doing its best to offer. The chasing moon was a thin grey ring of the same diameter as the implicit sphere, about 200 kilometers across, which in turn made it about the same size as the wheels of Poseidon. The width and thickness of the ring were also in proportion to the wheels. They would have better data as the moon reduced its spin even further, but on the evidence presented so far, Kanu had little doubt that additional information would only confirm the observations to date. He knew nothing of the M-Builders, still less of their psychology, but it struck him as profligate in the extreme to create two distinct kinds of thing which were all but identical in their major dimensions. No, he was sure of it. The moons were identical to the wheels. The wheels were down in the sea, and the moons were in space, but they were the same class of object, simply assigned different functions.
"How much of this," he asked, "is ringing a bell?"
"All of it,"
Dakota said.
"A moon always detached from its orbit and closed on us as we approached. The moons are the basic line of defense, the sentience filter. In a short while, it will sample us."
"Am I going to like that?"
Nissa asked.
"It depends how you feel about terror."
The moon, or more accurately, the wheel, continued its approach. Within minutes, its rate of spin had dropped to a few rotations a second. Then, with surprising abruptness, it locked still, its central axis aligned with Icebreaker. It was closing at a rate they could never have outrun, even with a fully functioning Chibesa core. Besides, Dakota was clear. It would have been perfectly futile to run. The moons allowed nothing to evade their scrutiny. If they veered from the reach of this one, the remaining moons would simply mesh their orbits tighter, and if by chance there had been some trajectory which allowed them to slip beyond the moons, Icebreaker would simply be destroyed, with long-range weaponry, as a precautionary measure.
"They allowed us through once,"
Kanu said.
"Your course was oblique to Poseidon. The moons determined that you had no intention of slowing or landing. Do not think of that as clemency. It isn't. The moon simply determined that you were neither a threat nor of interest to them. They guard their energy carefully. Nothing is without cost, even to the M-Builders. But you still did very well to survive after your entanglement with the Watchkeeper. Be glad you never went deeper."
"I'd be glad if we weren't going deeper now,"
Nissa said.
"For years, decades, I lived for this."
But after a silence, Dakota added,
"Now, I am not so sure."
They watched as a silver filament formed a cord between two parts of the moon's inner arc. The filament lengthened until it spanned the diameter, like a single, hubless spoke. They had seen nothing of how the filament was generated, or any suggestion of how it was sustained.
"What is it?"
Kanu asked.
"The means by which we shall be sampled," said Dakota. "It's a physical scanning process. a kind of examination by touch. But do not be alarmed. This is not the thing that will harm us.
The moon had begun to rotate again, but now the axis of rotation was at right angles to its previous orientation. The spin accelerated quickly, drawing the single silver spoke into a flat silver disc. The disc was slightly translucent, stars and planets still visible through it. Now the wheel began to gain on Icebreaker, until the silver surface was only a few hundred meters aft of the vessel.
"The first time," Dakota said, "we thought this must be a weapon. We believed we were going to die. In hindsight, though, it would have made a very clumsy tool of execution. We should have understood that it was a learning machine, not a weapon."
Kanu studied the bridge display. The schematic outline of the ship showed a sketchy, barely apprehended surface closing in from behind like a fog bank.
"What will happen when it touches us? Will it pass through the hull?" "The sampling surface will not be interrupted. It will pass through every system of Icebreaker, including the Chebeza core."
"And us?"
"From the perspective of the M-Builders, we are all just systems of the ship."
The silver wall had begun to consume the ship from the tail end, but there were no emergency warnings, no sense of any damage or impairment to the propulsion systems beyond that which they had already sustained. Icebreaker was aware of the surface, passing around it, but had no perception of any more significant violation of its integrity.
"I want to see this," Nissa said, "for real, with my own eyes."
"You will, soon enough."
"I mean, while there's time to compose some last thoughts. Will it matter if we move around?"
"Nothing you think, say, or do will make the slightest difference now," Dakota assured her. "This is the price of your forgiveness, inspiring us."
"Would you rather we hadn't?"
"I suspect you will come to believe so."
"Such gratitude," Nissa said.
"Oh, I am grateful. You had the means to escape, and we were safely unconscious. You could hardly have been blamed had you put yourselves before the Risen. I still wonder why you did not. You had everything to gain, and now you have nothing. But I can still look myself in the eye in a mirror," Kanu said.
He followed Nissa. Instead of going directly to the central shaft, she stopped at the spacesuit locker and began donning layers as quickly as she could. For a moment, Kanu merely watched, wondering how she thought a spacesuit was going to help her when the silver surface arrived. But the impulse to do something was inarguable, as human as the reflex to raise a hand against a striking knife. He began to put on his own spacesuit, skipping the usual safety checks for the sake of urgency.
"I know this won't make much difference," Nissa said, "but if the ship breaks up around us, I don't want to die with vacuum in my lungs. I'll take oxygen starvation over decompression any time."
"I've never been keen on drowning," Kanu confessed. "I imagine the two scenarios aren't all that different."
They left their helmets off for now, judging that there would be time to put them on if the ship really did begin to suffer some catastrophic structural failure. With their helmets tucked under their arms, they continued further into the ship. They did not have far to go before they reached the end of the central shaft, which ran a significant part of the distance back to the propulsion section. The shaft stretched away before them, picked out by running lights. They floated there, holding gloved hands. Neither of them needed to say anything. They could see what was coming. The end of the shaft was a moving silver surface. It filled the shaft perfectly, as smooth and tight-fitting as a plug of liquid mercury. It was slightly mirrored, so they were able to see the converging perspective lines of the shaft. Far in the distance, where those perspective lines pinched together, lay their own tiny reflections. Two floating suited forms, barely distinguishable from each other.
"The ship is still there, beyond the surface," Swift said. "We would know by now if that were not the case. It is not a destructive sampling process. The material must be examining matter on the molecular level, then reconstituting it as it passes through."
"Shut up, Swift," Nyssa said. "I need to face this without you in my head."
Kanu squeezed her hand. "It'll be all right." His instincts told him to try to paddle away from the approaching surface, but he could never have made enough speed to outpace it. Besides, there was nowhere to go. At least this way, they would face it with dignity. It came fast, appearing to accelerate as it consumed the last few meters of the shaft. But that must have been an optical illusion. Kanu stiffened his body and held his breath. It was impossible not to, even as his rational mind argued that it would make no difference. Nyssa's grip tightened on his own.
"We were married once," she said.
"Yes."
"And then not married."
"To my regret. But I am glad we came back into each other's lives."
"However it happened."
"Yes."
She nodded at the nearing surface.
"It's not a ring, but it is silver. When it touches us, we'll be united. I don't know if that'll be good or bad, but we may as well make the best of it."
"I agree."
"Let's say it remarries us, even if that's the last thought we hold in our heads. Do you agree, Kanu?"
For a moment, her words had punched a hole through him. He had been hoping for her absolute forgiveness, but never counting on it. The human capacity for kindness was as infinite and inexhaustible as it was surprising. He had done nothing to earn this moment, and yet he would not refuse it.
"Totally,"
he said, pinned between joy and horror.
"Swift," she said quietly, "don't say a word, but you are our witness."
Swift did not say a word, but they both sensed him there, fully participant in the same alien betrothal. Then the surface was on them, and in the exquisite and momentary bliss of their remarriage, they also knew the terror. Except terror, now that they were in it, was not quite the right word. They struggled to capture the essence of it. After the surface had passed through them and continued on its way, their bodies and minds put back together. But it was both more and less than terror. Better, they thought, to describe it as a total apprehension of the consequences of the present direction of their actions. A kind of absolute, unflinching understanding that they were assuming a responsibility, not only to themselves, but to every creature of their kind, across all their worlds and systems. That they were here at the sufferance of the M-Builders, and that from this instant on, they would be judged against the lofty priorities of that civilization, rather than their own. That the M-Builders offered a guarded welcome to the wise and the curious, but reserved only punishment for the foolish and the rapacious. That merely to think in such parochial and human terms was itself an error, and a dangerous one. The M-Builders had confronted the single most daunting truth facing all intelligent civilizations and arrived at their own response to that truth. That other cultures were free to learn from their example, if they so chose. That the gathering of knowledge was not to be discouraged, and that these guests were at liberty to study the structures and inscriptions of Poseidon as they pleased. The guests would be pleased to hear that the inscriptions contained additional operating guidelines for the transmitting elements of the Mandala network, that obsolete but harmless set of toys that the M-Builders had left in place for the benefit of lesser civilizations. But there was something more. For on Poseidon, The M-Builders had encoded a complete statement of their response to the ultimate truth of life's fate in the cosmos, and these lesser civilizations were free to incorporate the facts of that response into their own strategic planning. But should the disclosure of that response result in the consideration of acts detrimental or injurious to the absolute security of the M-Builders, they would not hesitate to enact species-level extinction. They had the means. They had done it before. They valued their word. Kanu understood. He felt it in his bones, as if this was knowledge that had been part of him for every second of his life, no more open to doubt than the specific blue of the sky, the sting of the sun on his neck, the salt of the ocean in his mouth. In the hundreds of millions of years since their abdication from the affairs of lesser civilizations, other cultures had come into contact with the work of the M-Builders. Some, like the Watchkeepers, never passed the first line of protection. They were rebuffed, often violently, but had suffered no wider retribution. Being hollow machines, being dead to consciousness, they were not deemed a threat, more a thing to be pitied, for they knew not what they were. Others had passed the sampling, known the terror, and believed themselves wise enough to bear that higher responsibility. But they had faltered, allowed their masks to slip, and the M-Builders, or rather their vigilant guardians, had decided they posed an unacceptable threat. Judgment had been delivered, and punishment meted out. The evidence of that punishment was not hard to find, even now. There were dead worlds, scorched of life. There were stars that had reached the ends of their nuclear-burning lifetimes too soon, as if something had stolen their fuel or made their fusion processes misfire. There were tracts of space where interstellar dust floated too hot or too thin, swept clear by the blasts of supernovae occurring in odd and suggestive clusters of temporal and spatial proximity, like a spree of murders. There were worlds orphaned from their stars, floating in space. All this and more was the work of the M-Builders. They would have done none of it without immense consideration, immense sorrow. Fundamentally, it was never their intention to kill. They would do only that which was necessary. In what might have passed for their alien hearts, they believed these cruelties were a greater kindness, perhaps the greatest kindness of all. They. Us. What are we? What were we? Much like you, Kanu Akinya, in our fashion. Life is short, against all the mute measures of the cosmos. A star barely draws breath. A world turns around that star 100 times. The galaxy is frozen in an instant of its turning like a jammed clock. A life begins, a life ends, nothing changes. The clock unjams itself for one vast, godlike tick, and a billion souls know their fierce, fast moment in the light. Until the clock jams again. Until the next tick. And yet, we are more than the sum of all those short seconds that make up our span. We learn, we give, we love, we are loved. We stir ripples into the wider fabric of social discourse. We are in turn moved by the ripples of other lives. We open books and know the thoughts of those who have lived before us. The hopes and sorrows and golden joys of earlier lives, they move us to laughter or to tears. Their days are over, but in the marks they have left behind, their lives continue to resonate. In that sense, their days are limitless. They have lived again in us. So it is with all our deeds, all our acts of cleverness and stupidity, our wars and inventions, our stories and our songs, the houses we make, the worlds we change, the truths we unearth. We end, we conclude, but our deeds continue. In this continuation, a retrospective meaning is shed onto every living moment. There is a point to love, if love itself is remembered. There is a point to the creation of beauty, because beauty will endure. All words, all thoughts, have a chance of transcending death and time. There is no heaven or hell, no afterlife, no divine creator, no great will behind the universe, no meaning beyond that revealed by our senses and our intellects. This is a hard thing to accept. Yet there is still a point to being alive, and that makes the acceptance bearable. But the universe withholds even this bleak consolation. Within its deeper structure, written like a curse into the very mathematics out of which it is forged, the universe contains a suicidal imperative. Vacuum itself is poised in an unstable condition. Given time, and the one certainty is that there will always be time, the vacuum, instability, will tip the universe into a new state of being. In that instant of uncreation, all information encoded in the present universe will be erased. No memory of anything will endure. No single experience of any living organism will be preserved. Nothing learned or discovered or made will survive. No art, no science, no history, no deed, no kindness, no fond thought, not a single moment of human happiness. Nothing will last. Nothing will matter. Nothing has ever mattered. When the sampling was done, when the silver wall had passed through them all, the moon spun its filament down to a clean silver spoke, and then withdrew it back into the rim. For a moment, it hung ahead of them, a moving ring, keeping pace with Icebreaker. Perhaps their fate was still in the balance, still being adjudicated. The moon retreated further still. It began to turn on its polar axis, blurring into a hard silver sphere. Then it veered off, returning to the orbit it had vacated during the chase. There were further layers of moons below, but they showed no interest in the ship. Carnu had just enough power to avoid coming too close to any of these moons, but not enough to stop Icebreaker's fall towards the top of the atmosphere. His head rang like a bell. It was still full of the terror. Not so much the emotion of the terror, he now knew, but rather a very specific sort of terrifying knowledge engraved in his consciousness with the indelible force of truth. He could still feel its argument, sounding out like an afterchime. He looked at his own hand, marveling at it, as if seeing it for the first time. He knew it for what it was, the instrument of a directed intelligence, an extension of himself, the means by which a being such as himself might do anything. Move earth, move water, move the stars, numberless multitudes of them, feel a glittery cascade of them run between his fingers like little grains of diamond sand, and knew that all of it was futile, that no action had ultimate consequence, that the best and the worst he could be would all be forgotten, that in the white moment of forgetting, even the fact that he had existed, the fact that he had left the tiniest mark on creation, would be lost, as would everything else. He was still with Nyssa. As they passed one of Icebreaker's airlocks, wordlessly, and with no prior exchange, they both slowed and looked at the lock, thinking of the void beyond it, the promise of immediate nullification. He could toss his helmet aside, step into that lock, release the air and life from his lungs. He had tried to kill himself on Icebreaker once before, but that attempted suicide had been born out of desperation, of seeing his death as the only thing that would stop Dakota, and at the same time not endanger the sleepers. He had reached the decision to kill himself only as the culmination of a bleak calculus, not because he had wearied of life or sought any kind of release in death. Life had not stopped surprising him. He was not yet ready to surrender it without good reason. It was different now. His death would have little impact on their chances, and certainly would not improve them. Equally, he had no immediate and pressing external reason for killing himself. Except that the terror had reached inside him, and negated every conceivable argument for his continued existence. It was purposeless, a life's ledger of futile acts that was itself doomed to be erased. Nothing would ever matter. Nothing would ever change that single fact. Nothing would ever make it more tolerable. How could the M-Builders ever have borne such knowledge? More to the point, how could Kanu Akinya? Nissa held his gloved hand.
No,
she said, and he understood. No, not yet.
I saw it,
he stated, filled with a shivering horror.
The terror. I understood it. It's in me, filling me like a black poison. It'll always be in me.
I saw it too,
Nissa answered.
It's in me as well. For the moment, it's all I can think of. I want to put my hands over my ears and shut it out. It's like a shriek of despair coming from every cell in my body, but we have to be stronger than the terror. It will pass. It must. Chiku endured it.
I'm not as strong as Chiku.
Nor am I. But there are two of us. I need you back from the edge, my man. And you need me. Remember, we are married now.
Kanu forced a nod. He did not feel as if there was strength enough in the universe to push aside that soul-swallowing negation he now felt inside himself. But he would have to try. For both their sakes. From the bridge, he ran the simulations over and over. There was no flaw in them, only a choice of deaths, various angles by which they would hit the air too steeply. Icebreaker had been armored against the crush of the European Ocean, but that was an entirely different proposition from the aerodynamics of transatmospheric flight.
Unless I'm missing something.
You're not, said Swift. Noah is our only option. It might get us down through that atmosphere.
Might.
Our approach speed is still very high. Noah was built to shuttle between the low orbit of Zanzibar and the surface of Crucible, not to cope with a velocity in excess of 80 kilometers per second.
Can it get us back into clear space?
Nissa asked.
Not at this speed. We'd still be too deep into the gravity well. At best, we can use Noah's remaining delta V to ease our atmospheric entry and trust that aerodynamic braking will do the rest.
Kanu nodded. It was pointless hoping for any more certainty than that. In truth, as he had told the crew of Mposi, he was already committed to their fate. He touched a glove to the control pedestal, feeling as if he were about to commit a loyal and dependable workhorse to the slaughterhouse.
It's just a machine, but I almost feel as if I'm betraying it.
That's Swift, bleeding over, Nissa said.
What about you, Swift? The image of you inside Icebreaker. Can you transfer it to Noah?
I hesitate to say. What's your estimate for the time left to us?
Kanu glanced at the display, squinting at the confusion of vectors and orbits. It looked like a wrestling match between many tentacled sea monsters.
It depends on the point of separation. Too early and the moons may mistake Noah for a second expedition.
or even interpret it as a threat. In any case, I don't want to go through the terror again quite so soon. Too late, and we won't have sufficient time to decelerate. Either way, we're looking at less than 15 minutes.
Swift removed his pince-nez and studied the lenses.
Then I would say we're short of time by approximately 3 weeks, minus, of course, those valuable 15 minutes, since that is how long it would take me to transfer a secondary image to Noah.
Then you're in trouble,
Nyssa said.
The image has served its purpose. The version of me inside Kanu still has a chance. If it helps, do not think of one as being distinct from and independent of the other.
I'm calling Goma,
Kanu said, making sure they still had a communications lock on the other ship.
They need to know what's happening. Once we hit the atmosphere, we may not be able to get a signal through.
He turned to the matriarch, swiveling his head in the neck ring of his suit.
Dakota, can you move in these conditions? You would have me confined somewhere else while you complete the evacuation.
No, I would have you aboard Noah, Hector and Lucas too. This much I'm sure of. None of us passed that test as individuals. It was something in the entirety of us that tipped the scales. Human, risen, machine. Together. A trinity. Like the first. For that reason alone, we are staying together.
After all our differences, after the threats, the deaths.
Recriminations can wait. Right now my main concern is that none of us dies a horrible fiery death. Does that sound like a plan to you?
If I were you, Nyssa said, I'd listen to my husband.